This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. After weeks of public and private deliberation, the articles of impeachment are here. House Democrats submitted two articles, abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Nowhere in the 9-page draft does the name Robert Mueller appear. But impeachment was not the only thing happening in America this week. Believe it or not, it wasn't even the only thing happening on Capitol Hill. Congress reached a compromise. Imagine that. Federal workers scored a win, and the military officially got a sixth branch with an interstellar reach. Here to help us make sense of this week's news is Darlene Superville, a White House reporter with the Associated Press. Darlene, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Tolu Olorunipa is a White House reporter for the Washington Post and my former colleague at the Miami Herald. Tolu, good to see you again.
It's good to be here.
And Alexis Simendinger is a national political correspondent with The Hill. Alexis, pleasure to have you back.
Great to see you.
We'd be most pleased to have your questions and thoughts about this week's news. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org. Comment on our Facebook page. Tweet us at 1A. And do bear in mind that this story is continuing to move as we speak, so your best bet is to keep an ear on your NPR member station for the very, very latest, and to keep an eye on NPR.org. So, as we speak, the House Judiciary Committee is meeting. We're not sure when exactly it's going to stop, but today it's supposed to be voting on articles of impeachment, something that we expected to happen last night. The hearing started in the morning, went on all through the day, into the afternoon, into the evening, late at night, and then the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Democrat Jerry Nadler, surprised everyone around 11 o'clock when he did this.
It has been a long 2 days of consideration of these articles, and it is now very late at night. I want the members on both sides of the aisle to think about what has happened over these last 2 days and to search their consciences before we cast our final votes. Therefore, the committee will now stand in recess until tomorrow morning at 10 a.m., at which point I will move to divide the question so that each of us may have the opportunity to cast up or down votes on each of the articles of impeachment and to let history be our judge. The committee is in recess.
Chairman.
That did not sit well at all with the gentleman you heard at the end of that clip saying, Mr. Chairman, that was Doug Collins of Georgia. He's the committee's ranking Republican.
That was the most Bush League play I have seen in my life, because they want to simply get it back on the cameras because it's after 11 o'clock tonight and they don't think enough people is watching. I have never seen anybody want to get in front of these cameras more than this group right here, because they don't have anything to impeach this president on. They don't have anything that they can move on except do Bush League stuff like this.
That was Doug Collins of Georgia. He's the committee's ranking Republican. Now, as we speak, the committee is voting. We'll get to the results in just a minute. But, Tolu, let me start with you. Delaying the vote, why did that happen? I mean, it seemed like there were many points yesterday when what's happening now could have happened yesterday.
Yeah, yesterday was just a partisan squabble, as you said, from morning all the way late until the night. And there was some sort of politicking going on with Republicans not wanting to follow what we heard was the agreement to end at 5 p.m. They wanted to continue sort of fighting and presenting a case in favor of the president. And then after it got so late into the night that Democrats realized that they may be accused of having a vote in the middle of the night to impeach the president, they decided, without consulting Republicans apparently, to put this off until the next morning and have it done this morning. I think it was just sort of a culmination of a day that was full of frustrations, full of back and forth attacks, personal insults, in which both sides really knew what the outcome was going to be, but they wanted to have this fight and they wanted to leave it all out on the playing field and really get all of their frustrations out, which have built up over the past several weeks. And they did that, and it ended up with, you know, the chairman banging the gavel and then the ranking member, you know, criticizing him, Republicans saying this was Stalinesque, these insults flying back and forth, which had been flying back and forth throughout the day, even late into the night. And I think it's a sign of what we're going to see continuing as this impeachment process plays out.
With regards to those insults, Alexis, yesterday's session was supposed to be a markup. It's where they bring forth the bill. People can proffer amendments. It's kind of Robert's Rules of Order come to life. And then they figure out what the bill's going to be and then vote on it. But Tolu is correct. I mean, one of the amendments that stood out from yesterday was when Republican Matt Gaetz of Florida proposed an amendment that would have replaced Vice President Biden's name with that of his son Hunter Biden. And then Matt Gaetz brought up Hunter Biden's history of alleged substance abuse. And then Democrat Hank Johnson said that that was the pot calling the kettle black, because Gaetz himself was pulled over for DUI in 2008. I believe those charges were either dropped or dismissed. Alexis, yesterday just really, it felt like a spitting match to me. I watched a lot of yesterday, and it just felt like guys, could you yell at each other off camera and then come in and do what we have to do? It was really personal.
It was personal. It was raw. We heard Republican ranking member Collins call it a kangaroo court. But I should also add that one of the elements of it that accrued as the day went on is as you listen to Senate Republicans talk about how they may be working out the rules for a trial, what they saw yesterday gave them pause because lawmakers started to talk about it as a kind of a show and a mess, a partisan mess. And so as Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, begins to talk to his caucus about what kind of rules, and he reaches across the aisle to Chuck Schumer of New York, one element that he's bringing up is not just his feeling that the president is innocent of this, but that this was just a display, an unruly display that he does not want to see in the Senate.
Worth noting, Darlene, as we speak, the House Judiciary Committee has just approved both articles of impeachment. The votes were completely party line. Abuse of power and obstruction of Congress were both approved by votes of 23 yeas and 17 nays. So perfectly party line vote, all the Democrats in favor, all the Republicans against. And that now goes to the full House of Representatives for a vote. Before we talk about what happens from here, Darlene, remind us about what the substance of these two articles was, particularly because the Republican pushback was that at least one of them, abuse of power, was kind of a made-up crime that they said the founders never intended to be grounds for impeachment. Walk us through that.
Right. Well, there are two articles of impeachment, and one is alleging the president abused his power in his dealings with Ukraine in terms of withholding some much needed military aid from Ukraine in order to pressure the president there to investigate Joe Biden and his son Hunter Biden, who had a seat on the board of an energy company in Ukraine. So that is the abuse of power article. The second one is obstruction of Congress, and that stems from the president and the White House and their position that they just will not, they just have refused to cooperate with the impeachment process.
Now, some Democrats, Darlene, wanted more articles of impeachment, particularly one related to the president's obstruction of the Mueller investigation. Article 2 or Part 2 of the Mueller probe investigation report said we're not allowed to even opine on obstruction of justice because of the Department of Justice's guidance that presidents can't be charged with that. But here's what we found and we leave it to Congress. Mm-hmm. So Robert Mueller kind of lobbed a softball at House Democrats if they wanted to bat it, but they chose not to.
That's right. And whether or not to include anything from the Mueller report had become a source of contention within the House Democratic Caucus. There were some that wanted to go that far and include some of the Mueller obstruction cases that he included in the report. And there were others that just didn't want to go there. And in the final analysis, they left it out. And we have the result that we just saw this morning.
But
two articles.
But Toll, at the end of the day, I think that also could have gotten sticky. I mean, the Republicans brought up the Mueller report a lot in terms of just saying, see, this is the Democrats. They hated Donald Trump in the campaign. They hated him when he got it. They've hated him since Inauguration Day. They tried the Mueller report. You know, Lisa Page and Peter Strzok tried to bring him down. Now there's this. This is just another effort for the Democrats to not have to face him at the ballot box.
Yeah, the Mueller report was actually very damning for the president. It included 10 instances of potential obstruction of justice. It did not say that the president had colluded with Russia, but Republicans were taking the Mueller findings as a victory. President Trump said it was total vindication. And when Mueller testified before Congress, he did not sort of become the star witness that Democrats wanted. We did see much more moving and emotional testimony in this Ukraine probe, and Democrats felt more comfortable in trying to present to the American people a case that President Trump had done something so egregious that he needed to be removed from office and withholding aid from Ukraine at the same time that he was pushing for these political investigations. The Mueller investigation, the Mueller charges were just not quite as moving for the American people, in part because Mueller himself was a reluctant witness. He did not want to testify. He did not provide much more information in front of the cameras than he did in his report.
Which was clear in the hearing.
Yes, it was clear that he did not want to be there. And Democrats did not move quickly with an impeachment after that. And some of the momentum did sort of fizzle out. And I think because there were so many moderate members of the House Democratic Caucus who did not come around to impeachment until this Ukraine scandal, it was clear that it was easier for Democrats to focus on a narrowly tailored impeachment just on Ukraine.
Now, during an interview with Fox News host Sean Hannity last night, the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he plans to be in, as he put it, total coordination with the White House as he prepares a Republican strategy for the impeachment trial. Here's part of what McConnell said.
And everything I do during this, I'm coordinating with White House counsel. There will be no difference between the president's position and our position as to how to handle this.
That was Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell speaking to Sean Hannity on Fox News last night. In a moment, Alexis, I'd like to know a little bit more about what might happen in the Senate. We're starting to get some of your thoughts in. We'll pick up on impeachment when we continue the Friday News Roundup with Tolu Olorunipa of The Washington Post, Alexis Simmendinger of The Hill, and Darlene Superville of The Associated Press. Before we move on, and we'll get back to the top stories out of D.C. in a minute, we wanted to remember a life that was cut short. You may have heard about the death of a rapper by the name of Juice WRLD. He died on Sunday after suffering a seizure at Chicago's Midway Airport. He was born Gerard Anthony Higgins and was part of a wave of young artists who rose to mainstream prominence via SoundCloud rap. It's a subgenre known by the online platform where they shared their work. He was known for recording off the top of his head in studio and for his exploration of melancholy themes like death, depression, and addiction. Juice WRLD had turned 21 just a week before he died. We'll get back to the Friday News Roundup in just a minute. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Strung out, wasted on a daily. Probably cause there's no one around me, numbing all my pain. Probably cause there's no umbrella to shield me from all the rain. Probably because you're the one playing the mind game. You hate me because I don't let you play the mind game.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. It's the Friday News Roundup with Darlene Superville of the Associated Press, Tolu Olorunipa of the Washington Post, and Alexis Simmendinger of The Hill. We welcome your questions and thoughts about this week's top stories. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Alexis, we played that clip from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell where he says that everything he does will be in coordination with the White House counsel. What might that kind of coordination look like? Clearly, this is a big deal to Mr. McConnell.
It is, and he has some choices to make, and what he's suggesting is not unusual as the majority leader of the party working with the president who's obviously defending himself against impeachment. But what he's saying is, I have some choices and I want to work them out with the White House about how we proceed. The challenge is that the president has suggested that he initially felt strongly that a Senate trial, which he anticipates would lead to his acquittal, should include witnesses so that he gets a very robust defense of his position, feeling that he's in a friendly audience of a majority of Republicans in the Senate. Senator McConnell and others in his conference have suggested that that's the last thing they want to see, that if the Republicans want to call witnesses, including, say, the president's eagerness to call Joe Biden or his son Hunter, that the Democrats are also going to argue, well, look, here's the witness list that we have, including Mick Mulvaney, for instance, the acting chief of staff, and others. And, you know, The Hill, my good colleagues at The Hill were reporting that there are Republican senators who said that would just invite World War III, and that's the last thing we want. That's why I was suggesting that when Mitch McConnell is pointing to the messiness that was seen in the House Judiciary Committee, he's sending a warning to his members. Let's make this quick, and he wants that warning to go to the White House, too. So he seems disposed to this idea of trying to make the trial, which he says they have to hold a trial, but he has the ability to write those rules with Chuck Schumer and the, you know, both sides and the White House. And he's suggesting, look, you know, here's one option. We could have both sides present their case and then we could call a vote on a simple majority to dismiss it. He's suggesting, he's hinting that he thinks there's enough moderate Republicans who are not going to go for that, that they want a full vote on the two articles of impeachment. But he'd like to see that go as rapidly as possible.
Well, Darlene, is that the way that this is supposed to go? I mean, you know, you do a quick Google search for Senate impeachment oath. And if you look back to the rules, they go back to the 1860s, and they reference doing impartial justice according to the Constitution and laws, so help me God. So there's a potential stickiness, I think, in that a trial is supposed to have some impartiality to it, but this is also an inherently political process. The House is led by Democrats. They have the power to accuse, but the Senate is supposed to have the power to judge. Mm-hmm. And this feels like it could get weird very quickly.
Well, it also kind of feels like it's already baked, right? The outcome is already baked. And we kind of knew that or had that sense because we all know the Senate is controlled by Republicans. Most Republicans are moving in lockstep with Donald Trump, and it seemed highly unlikely that the Senate would vote to convict and remove him from office. But when you listen to what Senator McConnell has to say, it kind of makes it seem that the negotiation that he's going to be doing with the White House and the White House counsel will just even bake that in even further. And this is the Mitch McConnell that said he wanted to make President Obama a one-term president. This is now the Senator McConnell that seems to be wanting to do everything he can to keep Trump in office.
Let me get to some of your comments about this. Mary writes, I would love to hear a senator or representative asked if a Democratic president had said the things that Trump said in his call with the Ukrainian president, if a Democratic president had refused to respond to Congress, would you still be voting the same way? For the record, I am a Democrat, and if I ruled the world, I would vote the same. Trump is setting precedent for the future administrations to flout the Constitution and ignore congressional oversight. Tolu, that's been one of the big themes of this whole thing, is that this is a precedent-setting moment. And I think because of that, it is, A, making more Americans pay attention. I hope, I trust, I pray that more people are paying attention. But B, it also makes this feel really, really big in a way that I don't think the Clinton or Nixon impeachments felt. Like, this feels like America is either going to continue to soar or fall off a cliff, depending on what happens with this one moment.
Yeah, and you would expect, especially after the partisan spectacle in the House, that the Senate would be the place where we have the greatest deliberative body, where senators would rise to the occasion and really put partisanship aside and really consider what this means for history, what this means for the future, what this means as a precedent. And we haven't seen much of that. We have seen some senators sort of try to be quiet about this and say that they're going to take this, their role as a juror, seriously and really consider these articles. But we have seen, for the most part, everyone falling into partisan camps on this, even though this is setting precedent, even though this deals with Congress's own jurisdiction when it comes to their oversight capabilities. President Trump has basically said that Congress does not have any responsibility or any opportunity to oversee his administration. He's denied documents. He said basically that there's a blanket denial of anything when it comes to congressional oversight, and that's a separation of powers issue. And when you hear Mitch McConnell saying, I'm going to coordinate with the White House, it does appear that that whole idea of checks and balances, separation of powers, is really falling to the wayside in pursuit of protecting the president when it comes to Republicans and pursuing impeachment when it comes to Democrats. And I don't expect us to see things rise to a higher level, even in the Senate, where it's supposed to be a more deliberative body than the House.
Alexis?
You know, you're talking about whether the American people see this as something really big. There's an argument among political scientists and pollsters that the Americans are seeing this as really small. And why I say that is there's a lot of concern about whether the idea that we are seeing impeachment so soon, let's say, after Bill Clinton. Now, most people think of that as a long time ago, but I cover that. It seems really fresh to me. But the idea that we went from 1868 to 1974 to 1998-99 and now, that we're seeing the normalization of impeachment, that it is becoming a small political weapon. And, you know, you can see that the polling for President Trump has not shifted downward dramatically, and definitely not among Republican supporters.
Before we move on, we'll talk about the Justice Department's Inspector General report. There actually was other news this week besides impeachment. Thank goodness. One last comment. Marcos tweeted, talk about how not even every House Democrat will vote in favor of impeachment and how impeachment will automatically die in the Senate. It will become a bipartisan effort against impeachment. Darlene, I do take Marcos's point. The full vote is planned for this coming Wednesday after the House Judiciary Committee has approved the language. there will be less unanimity. I think Marcos is right. Less unanimity among House Democrats. I think the real story is whether there will be unanimity among House Republicans, too, whether anybody is going to break and say, no, I've seen the evidence and I'm falling away from President Trump.
Right. And you had two House Democrats on the previous vote, not vote with Democrats and vote against the whole impeachment process, starting the impeachment process, I think that vote was. So you could see some moderates perhaps fall away. Nancy, Speaker Pelosi has said that she's not whipping her members on this vote. They have to vote their conscience. And so, you know, we could be surprised next week when this when these articles get to the floor.
Could you just clarify that term, whipping her members?
Whipping
just
her members.
We get that, yeah. But I just don't want somebody to have an image of Nancy Pelosi that ain't real.
Nancy Pelosi walking around with a real whip.
Right.
It's a term used in Congress where members are not being polled or questioned or surveyed on how they're going to vote on a particular piece of legislation.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying
that,
because I don't want anybody to walk around, think that she's walking around just going, we have stronger methods of making you vote. Let's move on and talk about the Inspector General's report. And if you have any more questions about this, please keep sending them in. Guarantee this will not be the last day that we talk about this. But this morning, the House Judiciary Committee did indeed approve both articles of impeachment for abuse of power and obstruction of Congress on a perfectly party line vote, 23-17. The full vote before the full House is scheduled for this coming Wednesday, December 18th. You'll have more coverage on your NPR member station and online at npr.org. Let's talk about the Justice Department, where a long-awaited report from its Inspector General into the Russia investigation came out this week. The Inspector General, Michael Horowitz, concluded that the FBI was justified in investigating the 2016 Trump campaign and whether it had ties to Russia, but that investigation still had a lot of errors. Tolu, talk about what else we learned from this Inspector General's report. I mean, this was the investigation into the Mueller investigation. What was the did we learn anything on balance, or was it kind of a draw?
Well, it had two main takeaways, and the report was very thorough and really dug in. I mean, they did hundreds of interviews and spoke to a lot of people who were involved in the Russia probe and involved in opening this investigation into whether or not there were improper links between Trump's campaign and the Russian government. The first takeaway is that this was not a partisan investigation. This was not an investigation that should not have been opened, that it was justified in its opening, that it was not influenced by partisan politics. There was no spying. So all of these talking points that we've heard from the president, from the White House about how the FBI spied on his campaign, this report shot it down. Now, the second part of the report was equally important in that it exposed serious misconduct and wrongdoing by the FBI in its surveillance applications to the FISA court, which is this court that authorizes spying or to surveillance, to use a term of art, on citizens. And that's a major civil liberties issue. And the fact that this report found so many shortcomings with the process and how FBI agents and the Justice Department pursued investigating and surveilling an American citizen without crossing all of its T's and dotting all of its I's, and in some cases making more serious shortcomings, is something that all Americans should be concerned about. We have seen the response to this report be very partisan, Republicans saying it's evidence that President Trump was the victim of a witch hunt and a hoax and this vendetta campaign by FBI agents. None of that is supported by the report. Democrats using the report to, you know, undercut President Trump's claims of being spied upon by the FBI and saying that it's a sign that President Trump should have been investigated and his campaign should have been investigated. But no one's really talking about the major issues.
One of the most high profile responses to that was from the head of the Justice Department himself, William Barr, the attorney general. He suggested that a new review led by his investigator would vindicate the president fully. Here he is speaking in an interview with NBC's Pete Williams.
A few weeks ago, I told him that he should spend just as much attention on the post-election period. And I did that because of some of the stuff that Horowitz has uncovered, which to me is inexplicable. Inexplicable. Well, what I said is their case collapsed after the election, and they never told the court, and they kept on getting renewals on these applications. There was documents falsified in order to get these renewals. There was all kinds of withholding of information from the court. And the question really is, what was the agenda after the election that kept them pressing ahead after their case collapsed? This is the president of the United States.
That was Attorney General William Barr speaking to NBC's Pete Williams. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Alexis, what about that? On one hand, we're relitigating an election that is over. It's over. Donald Trump won the election, and this has kind of been a running narrative since he was inaugurated. On the other hand, there are lawmakers on both sides of the aisle who have real problems with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, the whole process of renewing, because you have to bring new evidence to get a FISA warrant renewed. You can't just go back with what you had. You have to prove this has been useful. Here's what we found. And then the court can say, OK, here's another warrant. So I'm not sure what to make of this at the end of the day.
Well, one of the interesting things about listening to the attorney general is that he could have said, but didn't quite say it, that he's concerned enough about what happened post-election and obviously what happened with the FISA warrants. This is all involving Carter Page, who was an advisor to then-candidate Trump's campaign, who had ties at the time with Russia. What we're seeing, though, is a drive to reform FISA, and you can see that building. It seemed to me that the attorney general was suggesting that that is what the administration would support, and we've seen bipartisan support, especially in the Senate, for that concept. In fact, there are going to be hearings and discussions about particular ways to do that. The FBI director, Christopher Wray, has suggested that the FBI might be open to that. So there may actually be something constructive that comes out of this, because the process that the FBI uses to seek those surveillance warrants is concerning enough to enough people. So, for instance, the New York Times reported that in 2018, more than 1,000 of those surveillance warrants were authorized, and only one had been turned down in total by a FISA judge. It's really a judge. It's not like a full court. They rotate. So there's a discussion about this process, and it seems to me that there is maybe something constructive that could be coming out of that if you listen to the lawmakers who know the most about it.
That it basically could be too much of a rubber stamp right now.
Correct.
Yeah. Let's move on and talk about trade. Jeff Char writes, this and the new deal with the pharmaceutical corporations are two amazing bipartisan achievements that are taking a backseat to the impeachment proceedings. Well, they are things that did happen, particularly talk of trade this week, because less than an hour after announcing the articles of impeachment, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced that she and the White House had reached a deal on trade. The U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, the one that replaces NAFTA, is set to pass the House of Representatives. Darlene, just in a basic level, what makes this new deal different from NAFTA that allowed the Democrats to sign on?
Well, one thing Democrats wanted, and Speaker Pelosi worked hard with the U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer and some Democrats in the House, they've been negotiating for a long time, were stronger provisions for labor provisions in Mexico. There were some environmental issues that were of concern to them. I believe also drug pricing was another issue. So those were some of the things that that they took basically a year to work on and reached this point this week where they were able to come out 1 hour after impeachment, like you say, and announce a deal.
Did that come as a shock to anyone that the Democrats were able to reach this deal?
I think so, yes. And also the timing was peculiar. I mean, you know, on the one hand, you have Speaker Pelosi and House Democrats saying, you know, here are these articles of impeachment and moving ahead with this process, this very serious process that could lead to the removal of the president. And then in the next breath, they're giving Trump something that he's been wanting for a very long time.
We'll pick up with that in just a minute when we continue the Friday News Roundup. Elizabeth writes, people need to be fed. People need to be housed. People need medical care. This is some BS. This is the kind of thing that leads to us eating the rich. We'll tell you what Elizabeth is referring to in just a minute. But before we move on, one more obit for one of TV's most beloved actors whose face you might not recognize, but you definitely recognize his work. Carol Spinney played Big Bird and Oscar the Grouch on Sesame Street for nearly 50 years. His characters helped children learn to read and write and to deal with life's lessons, including the episode where Big Bird dealt with the death of Mr. Hooper.
And we can remember him and remember him and remember him. Much as we want to. But I don't like it. It makes me sad.
We all feel sad, Big Bird.
Carroll Spinney died on Sunday. He lived to be 85. More of the roundup in a minute. Stay close.
The most remarkable word I've ever seen. Abkadabke Jekyll and not where Stu Rex is. I sure wish I knew exactly what I mean.
Back now to the roundup with Darlene Superville, Tolu Olowanipa, and Alexis Simmendinger. We still have a bit more time for your questions and thoughts. 1A@WAMU.org. Kelly writes, McConnell said the Senate won't take it up until after the impeachment trial. Why is there no blowback on that? Why does he just hold bills back from votes and stall their forward momentum? Tolu, what about that? McConnell had said he won't bring up the deal in the Senate before the end of the year and said that it is, quote, not as good as he would have hoped, unquote. What is it that he does not like about this?
Well, first of all, it's a very political play by McConnell, who has been willing to use politics when it comes to running his chamber. Everything from, you know, holding back a vote on President Obama's Supreme Court nominee all the way through rushing judges through for Trump. So he does believe that holding back a vote on USMCA, the president's trade deal, until after impeachment allows Republicans to say, we're not able to get the work of the country done because Democrats are focusing so much on impeachment. This trade deal, which would lead to jobs and more trade and better support for our farmers, has to be delayed because Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats are so focused on trade.
Which now, is not true.
It's not true, but it's the message and the argument that McConnell wants to make. He could pass this as soon as the Democrats pass it in the House. Republicans are largely in support of this in the Senate. There's bipartisan support for this. They could pass it. And even President Trump originally said that this should be passed and by the end of the year. He wanted to make this his top legislative priority for 2019 and get it done before the end of the year. But because of politics, it's going to get pushed into 2020. Now, some Republicans feel that they were kind of left out of the process because Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats almost exclusively negotiated with the administration, with President Trump, to get this to a place where Democrats could support it in the House. And some Senate Republicans feel that the president gave too much away, whether it's on, you know, environmental or labor regulations or some of the other provisions within this major deal just to get Democratic support. And we've heard in reporting Democrats say we ate their lunch and they have taken a victory lap on this trade deal because they believe that they changed it so much from the original deal in Democrats' favor that several Republicans aren't so happy with it and there's some pushback and there's not a rush to get it done before the end of the year.
It's had a really wild evolution, Tolu, like from being this deal that we were talking about at Mexico and Canada having their issues with it and then going back and forth and drama between President Trump and Justin Trudeau of Canada and then what will this mean with the trade deal and then also the crisis at the southern border and now it's back in Capitol Hill. I don't know if we will ultimately look back at this as kind of a Pyrrhic victory in a way, that the president may have gotten the trade deal he wanted, but there's so much blood on the ground that it may or may not feel like a win.
Yeah, and you have to remember there was a point at which President Trump wanted to pull out of NAFTA completely back in 2017, and that caused so much dysfunction within the White House.
With no replacement deal in hand.
With no replacement. There were people actually within the White House that took the drafting documents for that off of his desk so that he wouldn't see it and he would forget about it. So this has been a roller coaster ride, and it does remain to be seen with these major, massive trade deals, even though this one does keep a lot of the structure of NAFTA. It remains to be seen what the impact is going to be on the economy, on trade. Obviously, President Trump wants to use it on the campaign trail in 2020 to say he was able to do something, even with Democrats in charge of Congress. But it's not clear what the political impact will be for 2020.
With regard to this deal, Lepica writes, the deal still has to be ratified in Canada, and with protections for their dairy farmers on the line, it won't happen any quicker than it did here. And until it does, it won't go into effect. Alexis, another big trade deal that the president had announced was a deal with China that is apparently within reach. The Chinese government held a news conference that started basically as our program was starting, and China says that it has agreed with the U.S. on a phase one trade deal. The latest we have from their news conference is that America will cancel tariffs on Chinese goods in phases, starting this Sunday when the tariffs were supposed to start taking effect. In response, President Trump tweeted in part, quote, they, meaning the Chinese, they have agreed to many structural changes and massive purchases of agricultural product, energy, and manufactured goods, plus much more, He went on to tweet, quote, "We will begin negotiations on the phase two deal immediately rather than waiting until after the 2020 election. This is an amazing deal for all," unquote. Now, Alexis, the original tweet also included some of what he claims are details of the deal. Some economists are saying that those details are not what China agreed to. And we know that in the past, we've heard that we're very close to a trade deal with China. Might this be different, or are we just kind of spinning in this on the same Mobius strip over and over?
Well, it could be different, but having not seen the details, it's hard to know exactly what the president is describing with exclamation points and rockets and, you know, all of that to know exactly. What we do know is that the president announced that there was a deal in principle in October, and here we are in December where he's saying we have a deal in principle. And the idea is also has emerged among some economists that while this is considered perhaps an opening to some sort of certainty or an end of this trade war that's been going on, that's really roiled markets and has made the business community concerned, not concerned that the president is going up against the Chinese, which they applaud, but the idea that it's going on to such an extent that it's had damage on the manufacturing sector and the farm community. So they're waiting to see what the results are. And remember, phase one was supposed to be the easier part, and it has turned out to be such a slog and so difficult to get the Chinese to even agree to do what they were already doing before the president went into his trade tariff policy, which was buying agricultural products. Remember, the Chinese were buying U.S. ag products and then stopped when the president applied tariffs.
That's a common refrain then.
So there is a little bit of the president started a fire and then wants the credit for putting it out attached to this. But we'll have to see what the details are. But you can see the financial markets are very hopeful that this is a turn.
Let's move on to another deal that Democrats and Republicans managed to agree on the Hill, even with all this impeachment stuff going on. And that had to do with the big defense policy bill, which is worth more than $700 billion. Darlene, this is the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act. Why is this ratification of the NDAA important?
It's important because for the first time, federal workers, when this passes and when it's signed by the president, and he has said he will sign the NDAA. And for the first time, there is a provision in the bill that will give federal workers 12 weeks of paid parental leave. That's something that has never existed before. Right now, they could only take unpaid leave. It will apply to civilian workers. It will apply to those in the military. And it's a pretty big deal. It's something the president has called for in some of his speeches before Congress. His daughter and advisor, Ivanka Trump, has also lobbied members of Congress on this issue since she joined the White House. And you have lots of advocacy groups around the country that have been wanting this for a very long time, and they see inclusion of this provision in the bill and providing this for federal workers as a model for private industry to go ahead and start those that aren't already providing some type of paid leave to follow the federal government's footsteps and provide parental leave for their workers too, paid parental leave.
Are we talking about all civilian workers in the Defense Department or all federal workers?
All federal workers.
Everyone.
Yes.
Now, there were a few provisions, Tolu, that made some other headlines, including the one that Elizabeth was writing about. Elizabeth writes, "People need to be fed, people need to be housed, people need medical care. This is some BS. This is the kind of thing that leads to us eating the rich." And what she was referring to is the provision that would fund and create the Space Force. This is something that came up a while ago in terms of creating a separate branch of the U.S. military that would deal specifically with kind of outer space defense. To be fair, there are deep space weapons that countries like China have been developing. So this is not the stuff of science fiction. It sounds like the stuff of science fiction, but Tolu, what is this really?
Yeah, this is an obsession of President Trump, and it has been for a couple of years. This hasn't been part of the Republican, you know, orthodoxy or platform in any major way until President Trump came on the scene and was just sort of enamored with this idea of creating a new branch of the military, having it be something that's part of his legacy where, you know, warfare in space or, you know, defense tied to what's happening in space is part of the military's new role and will be. And what Darlene was saying about this major new expansion of federal benefits, parental leave for federal workers, this is something that the president traded away in order to get the Space Force because he wanted it so much. He really was obsessed with making sure that he was able to pass this, and he gave away something that Democrats have been trying to get for years, if not decades. And some Republicans are not happy about this new expansion of federal spending, but the president really wanted the Space Force, and his daughter wanted paid for parental leave, so he was happy to make this trade, and it will lead to this new branch of the military, and it will be something that President Trump talks about on the campaign trail, because he wanted to focus on the fact that he was able to expand the military into outer space.
Well, and even beyond that, Tim asked, what is the function of a space force? I mean, the U.S. Air Force already deals with some of the purview of the Space Force. This would just kind of take it from the Air Force and put it somewhere else?
Yeah, and there was a lot of talk within the Air Force that they were not in favor of Trump's earliest plans to create an entirely new branch of the military. In this compromise deal, the Air Force will still be involved, they'll still be in charge, but it will be more highly funded and a more highly organized effort to provide defense in space, to make sure that the U.S. is competitive when it comes to some of the new exploration that's taking place, and to make sure that President Trump has a talking point on the campaign trail where he can at least say, I created this new branch of space warfare, and that's something that he has focused on a lot as he's tried to campaign for 2020.
Speaking of talking points, I know that several of you who are just joining us had a lot of points you wanted to talk about regarding impeachment and the vote this morning in the House Judiciary Committee to advance two articles of impeachment. Not to worry, we will be talking impeachment next week, of course, because it'll be a day that ends in Y. But in the meantime, your NPR member station will have all the latest details. Keep an ear on your NPR member station and eye on NPR.org. And feel free to send us your questions whenever. We might include them next week, 1A at WAMU.org. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Let's shift away from the Beltway before our time is up and head to New Jersey, where a shootout at a cemetery and a Jewish market in Jersey City left six people dead, including the two shooters. Officials initially said the location of the attack was random, but it's now being investigated as an act of terror. Here's New Jersey's Attorney General Gurbir Graywall at a press conference in Jersey City yesterday.
Let me be plain at this point. The evidence points towards acts of hate. I can confirm that we're investigating this matter as potential acts of domestic terrorism, fueled both by anti-Semitism and anti-law enforcement beliefs.
That was Gurbir Graywall, the Attorney General of New Jersey, speaking yesterday at a press conference. Meanwhile, President Trump has signed an executive order that would allow the government to, quote, effectively interpret Judaism as a race or nationality and not just a religion, unquote. The move would extend civil rights protections to Jewish people on college campuses where the administration says anti-Semitic and anti-Israel movements have flourished. Alexis, I have seen the inside of this debate firsthand. I used to teach at UC Berkeley, and I remember seeing students clash on this at times. Not the bulk of the student body, but a significant number. But what is this really about, Alexis? Is this what it is on its face, or is there more to it?
Well, there's way more to it, and it is very complicated. But one of the elements of this is that the president was influenced by his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and others outside in the community who persuaded him that this executive order would be beneficial, almost in place of something that Congress had talked about over some period of time, but also would be helpful to him in his reelection, because we know the president is making a very strong play to peel away some Jewish voters and who he has thought were reliably Democratic voters and should be supportive of him because of his policies towards Israel. One of the elements of this, though, that has been sparked is a deep division within the Jewish community about the utility of this and what this, the implications of it, and what it will really mean. So what we're embracing now in the aftermath of this executive order is whether this is viewed as really a plus to encourage more supervision of discrimination on campuses, or whether this is actually going to result in an effort to close off free speech. And also at the heart of this a discussion about policy? In other words, pro-Palestinian? Is that an opportunity for students? Is that what they're talking about? Or are they really talking about anti-Semitism?
Before we go, the topic that I know everybody here really wanted to talk about, the Golden Globes, right? I know you were all just, don't give me that look. But the big award season is gearing up, and this week we did get the nominees for the Golden Globes and the Screen Actors Guild Awards. Four of the Globe Best Picture nods go to movies from Netflix: The Irishman, Marriage Story, The Two Popes, and Dolomite Is My Name. Some of our movie club selections are also nominees. Jojo Rabbit got Golden Globe and SAG nominations for Best Picture. On the TV side, most of the top awards for series and ensembles went to shows from HBO or Netflix, like The Crown, Big Little Lies, and Barry. Some shows that generated big buzz, like Watchmen and The Mandalorian, earned no nominations. But the big snub this year went to broadcast television. Of all the broadcast networks, only NBC got one nomination for Sterling K. Brown of This Is Us. The Golden Globes are on January 5th. The SAG Awards are on January 19th. Am I the only one who is upset that Watchmen and The Mandalorian got nothing? Regina King. Am I the only one here who loves Regina King?
I like Regina King, too.
Okay. Well, then, Darlene Superville, you get 10 points for the day. She's a White House reporter with the Associated Press, and Darlene, you may come back as a result. Thanks,
thank
Darlene.
Thank you.
Tolu Olorunipa, we'll consider letting him back in the door. He's a White House reporter for the Washington Post. Thanks, Tolu.
Thank you.
And Alexis Simondinger, national political correspondent with The Hill. Do you love Regina King?
I do.
You may come back.
Thank
Thanks, Alexis.
You.
Our lead audio engineer is Jake Cherry. Gabby Healy, Chris Castano, and Aileen Humphreys produce our digital and on-demand content. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you very much for listening, and enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.